superconductivity in three-dimensional MOT insulators. Actually, I was inspired to think about it by some experimental results, which are rather old, actually. So I will come to it towards the end. So after some introduction, I'll talk about MOT insulators at seat of unconventional magnetism and high temperature superconductivity. This is for non-experts. And then finally, I will go into atomic and molecular orbitals, the Antlerer effect, dimensionality, and so on. Because finally, all these fascinating things that we are doing comes from some dirty looking material. If any of you have seen lanthanum copper oxide, it looked like a black powder, very unimpressive, not shining, but it becomes a high temperature superconductor. Then I will talk a little bit about successful materials, namely cuprates, iondictites, and fullerites, why they are successful. Then I will discuss two examples, in fact, the second example in more some detail. And then it will take me naturally to frustrated magnetism in FCC lattice and the coexisting of various things. And I will conclude with some discussion. So we are having exciting time in the field of quantum matter, you all agree. We are witnessing an unexpected richness in the quantum world, and novel states, new ideas, new theoretical ideas, mathematics and tools help from enlarge Hilbert space. Previously, we were contented with the Hilbert space that we live in. Now we enlarge it and play with it and come back to our physical Hilbert space. New mathematical ideas like cohomology, dynamical mean field theories, BMRG, numerical methods, and very efficient representation of low energy quantum many body states, and gain new insights and address strong coupling problems. For example, matrix product states, tensor networks, MeRA, and so on. And this tantalizing ADS-CFT correspondence, an exciting route, but to me it's full of mystery and magic. They get results which are very, very much like what you see in the experiments, but you don't know the starting point. You don't know what is your Hamiltonian or a model, so it's full of mystery. But these are all very exciting things that are happening. And then if you look at kind of states, heavy fermions, that's a whole world. There is interesting magnetism, there is spin liquid physics, very heavy effective mass, 500 times the electron effective mass, still Fermi liquid like, quantum ferroelectrics, an untouched corner, charge density wave system, spin density wave system, MOT insulators, very recently topological insulators, quantum spin liquids, high-TC superconductors, non-Fermi liquid states, integer fractional quantum Hall states, Dirac, and so on. And novel phenomena such as emergent fermions, emergent gauge fields, quantum number fractionization, quantum orders, topological entanglement, anions, Majorana fermions, many of these things we are all interested in. So all these things are happening. Now, we have to go beyond elemental metal like mercury or aluminium to realize this and discover or synthesize novel material. And of course, cold atom offers an exciting but challenging route now, because there are claims that you can realize many of our dear models there, but there are problems going, for example, going even to get antiferromagnetic ordered state in a MOT insulator, leave alone superconductivity. So, but it's a very, very fascinating route. So we will focus on real down to earth materials which you can touch. So if you look at the systems, the kind of things that these rich physics come about, they look seemingly very complex. But however, you know, if you model it, when you extract the relevant physics, they are often described by a simple Hubbard model or a free electron tight bending model with spin orbit coupling and so on. So just to show you that materials don't come in simple way, for example, the Nobel Prize winning lanthanum copper oxide is what is called a layered perovskite. There is copper surrounded by oxygen, and then you have lanthanum layer, and you have barium, which replaces a little bit of lanthanum. And then MgB2, it looks like graphite with honeycomb lattice of boron with intercalated magnesium. So it looks like intercalated graphite. Then there are 2D fullerene metals with some beautiful organic molecules. Yes?
So MgB2 is a metallic?
MgB2 is metallic.
And it's a, this boron layer is a metallic.
Exactly. So it's very interesting.
So Mg2 anything about the
correct.
So moment or no?
If you look at the periodic table, boron is to the left of carbon. So Mg donates 2 electrons. So makes it basically carbon. So you have essentially carbon layers after the electron acquisition. So the band structure looks like graphite. Except that Mg is inert.
Inert.
So having donated 2 electrons, it's a closed shell. So it provides ionic binding in this direction. And the band structure looks like graphite. But there is some change, some of the sigma band has floated up and there are some hole pockets. So it's a very fascinating system. Even though people claim that it's solved in terms of standard electron phonon coupling, I don't believe so. There is some rich physics there. Then these 2D fullerene metals and very recently these topological insulators, where you notice that all this beautiful physics comes out of these quintuple layers of bismuth and selenium. So they are stacked and there is van der Waals coupling. And you get this Dirac cone at the surface. Amazing. To get that, you know, it's not straightforward. You'll have to do this. But nature seems to do it very happily for us. Because lanthanum copper oxide was man-made. It was synthesized. In fact, it was in the lab of some of my friends at Bangalore. But they didn't look for superconductivity. So they missed it. MgB2 was there in the, apparently, boxes in every lab. It was a very well-known metal. But then they didn't go to low temperature and they found out a 40 Kelvin superconductivity there. Similarly, organic salts, so-called ET salts. So everywhere what you will find is there is some key molecular orbital which is localized, for example, here, or which is localized in this octahedra or spread here. And there is a famous Chevrel phase. In fact, very beautiful molybdenum sulfur clusters in which there are some molecular orbitals and then electronic conduction takes place between them. They have very interesting superconductivity, which even now we don't understand completely. They are called bad actors from BCS theory point of view. Then this new family of iron nictide superconductor family, where you have layers, lanthanum oxygen and iron arsenide layers. And then of course artificial systems like fractional quantum Hall effects, inversion layers and heterostructures. So the neat physics that we are looking for and we are enjoying resides in some complex material. So to really appreciate what is going on, it's good to have some insight into some of these materials. And that will give us a good guidance. Then we can also interact with experimentalists more fruitfully. So having said this, I will spend some 5 or 10 minutes talking about MOT insulators as a seat of quantum spin liquids and high-T superconductivity and all the things that we have been seeing before. This is something very elementary. Mott suggested that let's think about a thought experiment in which you have a collection of hydrogen atoms forming a cubic lattice. And let us say that the lattice parameter is close to Bohr radius and the wave functions will overlap. And we will form a band which is made up primarily of 1s orbitals. And it will be a half-filled band because we have 1 electron per site. So in k space, we can put 2 electrons, we will have a half-filled band. It's a matter. So we agree that Bloch's theorem should work because you gain a lot of kinetic energy or delocalization energy, Coulomb interactions, most of it are screened, and so on. But then Mott asked the question, what will happen, suppose we do a hypothetical experiment in which expand the lattice and make the lattice parameter larger than Bohr radius, much larger. Then it's very clear to us, intuitively, that we won't form a band. Because if you try to form a band and delocalize the electron, an electron has to pluck itself out from its own site, and then that's a large lot of energy, ionization energy, and it has to place itself on top of another electron in a neighboring hydrogen atom. So that may cost energy. So common sense tells us that this should be an insulator. It cannot be a metal when the lattice parameter is very large. Whereas if you do band theory, if you insist that you will do band theory, you will get a half-filled band of metal, but the band will be extremely narrow. And energy bandwidth or energy gain will be very small compared to any Coulomb repulsion that you talk about. That's why we say that we get a Mott insulator, which is schematically represented in terms of an upper Hubbard band and lower Hubbard band, which says that we want to add a carrier, basically, or remove an electron and then make it conducting, you need a finite energy gap. But however, what is interesting is, having done that, it's an insulator, charges cannot move, but the spins are essentially dangling. So you have soft spin degrees of freedom. So this is what a Mott insulator is. Finally, a Mott insulator, charge degrees have become very degrees of freedom become very hard, but the spins are very soft. They can be easily manipulated. If you take the limit, the electron correlation is infinity in a Hubbard model, you have essentially 2 to the power of n fold degeneracy of this spin degrees of freedom. Now, quantum mechanics, quantum fluctuations modify this. What it says is, suppose you have 2 electrons in 2 neighboring hydrogen atoms, there can be a quantum fluctuation to this state. So it's a virtual state, and then you can come back to an exchange configuration. And this is possible, or Pauli principle will allow it only if you have a singlet correlation between the two. For example, if the 2 spins are parallel in a spin triplet state, there is no way by which I can hop. So quantum fluctuation is not allowed, so energy gain is 0. So Pauli principle plus Coulomb repulsion starts distinguishing a singlet and a triplet state. So that's the beginning of quantum magnetism. So this we summarize by saying that there is an energy gain. For example, this process, it's a second order process, T square over U, and there is a factor of 4, and you gain energy, so it's minus. So it appears as, in the spin subspace, as an antiferromagnetic exchange Hamiltonian. So this is the beginning of magnetism. If you take just 2 sides, you can very convince yourself that the ground state will be a singlet like this. But when you put several sides together, there is a problem. Whether I satisfy this neighbor or that neighbor, I do something else. And often, as we learn in Kittel, this will lead to long-range antiferromagnetic order. But it need not be always so. For example, there are situations like in finite systems, like benzene, where Pauling argued long back, there will be resonance between. Because if you think about benzene, it's a small Mott insulator. Because the hopping matrix element is about 2 electron volt, and the U for benzene is about 10 electron volt. So you can write down a Heisenberg type of model, but the ground state doesn't correspond to an antiferromagnetic order. Quantum fluctuation takes you between various states, and there is a resonance. Similarly, you can imagine a resonance, for example, even in a square lattice like this, or one step of that resonance. So what it tells is that if you have a small spin, there is a very interesting possibility that instead of long-range antiferromagnetic order, that you would go into a resonating valence bond state. So this is RVB story. I will not go into the detail of that. So Anderson, inspired by the discovery of superconductivity in cuprate, what he said was that in cuprate, what we have is, you have a situation very similar to what Mott suggested. We have a square lattice of copper spins. And these spins form antiferromagnetic coupling, and they start resonating. And what Anderson said was that they are resonating, then when you dope the system, you are basically removing some charges, and then these resonating singlets start coherently moving around and leading to superconductivity. And if you look at the scales, this singlet coupling is not a Fermi surface phenomenon, it's a quantum chemical phenomenon with energy, large energy scale like J, which for cuprate is 1500 degree Kelvin. So here is an opportunity for singlet formation and possible delocalization. So this was Anderson's point in his paper, that let's think about Mott insulator as a reference state. When you talk about high temperature superconductor, instead of thinking about Fermi surface, you have a Mott insulator. There are singlet correlations or pre-existing Cooper pairs, and they cannot carry charge current, they can carry only spin current. So what doping does is something profound. It charges some neutral singlets, and the resonating charge singlets form a superconducting state. So Anderson's 1987 science paper was very straightforward and simple. The idea was very simple. He wrote down some possible variational wave function and gave several insights. And some of these things were worked out at that time by some of us. And what is interesting is, Anderson suggested a very important family of wave function we call as resonating valence bond state wave functions, which is a very simple physics. It doesn't look like a wave function that you will write down for a magnetic state. For example, we never write down wave function for a magnetic state. We assume some classical spin configuration like an antiferromagnetic order and do semi-classical or spin wave theory. But here is the situation where long-range order may not exist. So we have to write down a wave function. And Anderson went back to RVB theory and said that RVB wave functions can be written as a coherent superposition of singlets in some state Aij. So what you do is you take a pair of electrons at site I and j, form a spin singlet, and then give it an amplitude Aij, and then sum over a all I and j. So there is an internal function, which is a function of the separation Aij, and you can put the center of mass to be zero, carrying zero momentum. And put, if nc is the number of sites in the problem, put half of that. So you fill the lattice. And of course, because you are dealing with Martin insulator, spin degrees of freedom alone are active, you do what is called a good solar projection, that is remove double occupancy. So this simple looking wave function is sufficiently general to describe almost all known unconventional magnetic states, such as Z2 spin liquid now, U1 spin liquid, SU2, chiral spin liquids, and even antiferromagnetic order, just through a proper choice of one pair function Aij. So it's a remarkably powerful wave function, which came through this quantum chemical insight of resonating singlet. And also what was Anderson's insight at that time was, RVB wave functions have an intimate connection to BCS wave function and reflect a potential superconductivity that could emerge on doping. In other words, we are all familiar with this BCS wave function. What we say is that we say that in K-space, there is a coherence between the unoccupied K-up and minus K-down state and occupied state. So this is basically BCS wave function. This VK by UK is a Cooper pair wave function. We are all familiar with it. What Anderson suggested is, take that wave function for at half filling and then remove double occupancy by good solar projection, and then you get this. So this is something, a simple exercise, that you take this wave function and then look at the n particle projected sector. It looks like this. It's like going from coherent state to a state with fixed particle number. So when you project, you have this. So there is a very neat mathematical connection between RVB wave function and the BCS wave function. So Anderson's observation was very simple. He said that I am unable to get superconductivity or off diagonal long range order in this wave function because of Kutzler projection. It prevents any charge fluctuation. Then he argued that suppose I move away from half filling and preserve the same form of wave function. He suggested immediately, he said that this will start developing off diagonal long range order. And this was verified variationally and various. So it's a remarkable family of wave function. Okay, so the message from RVB theory is Martin insulators are seats of high temperature superconductivity. Super exchange is the glue. And if you go back to conventional superconductivity, because the scattering that leads to attraction between electrons is restricted to a small shell, h cross omega d divided by Fermi energy in the standard superconductor, TC is not governed by that number, but by the fraction of holes that you have created, you have, that is the ability for the singlet to move around. So you have a jump from exponential dependence on this small number to this large number. Therefore, KT is not BCS formula, but X times T, where X is the doping fraction, T is some hopping fraction. So this is a remarkable jump from the conventional BCS point of view, from the point of view of starting with a Martin insulator and spin liquid state and doping it. Okay, so this is the old story. I mean, it was so interesting that even before the phase diagrams came, that this is what we wrote in our paper, saying that you have this RVB mean field theory below that there are singlets, but they are unable to cohere because the charges are incoherent. You come down, there is some kind of Bose coherence developing, and you got a formula for TC, which is like a two-dimensional Bose condensation formula, where there is no dependence on J until some optimal doping. So many things followed from that very nice insight of Anderson. Okay. Now, lots of interesting developments at that time, topological excitations in this model, and then quantum dimer model, and topological order, and then quantum order from Wien, and various exciting developments. So So one thing that we did at that time was this enlarging the Hilbert space, that is, we rewrote the super exchange in terms of electron operator. Then it's very suggestive of Cooper pairing. It says that this counts the number of singlets on a bond. So this term says that if two electrons on a neighboring side, two neighboring sides form a singlet, you gain an energy minus J. If they are in a spin triplet state, it is zero. So this is how standard super exchange gets modified in this representation. that immediately suggests to us some kind of decoupling, a mean field decoupling, a la BCS. And that's what led to RVB mean field theory and extended Hilbert space. And you get a variety of interesting solutions, including a solution that has a pseudo-Fermi surface. And what is interesting is, even though we have written a BCS-like wave function, wherein manifestly it's a spin liquid state, but if you go inside and analyze long range order, it was found recently by Tao Li and Ashwin and collaborators, that actually this system, which we thought is a spin liquid in the pseudo-Fermi surface, indeed has long range order also. So this is another remarkable thing, a variational wave function, which is essentially a free Fermi C, which has charge fluctuations and spin fluctuations. Once you control charge fluctuation through good solar projection, reveals long range antiferromagnetic order spontaneously. So it's a beautiful example. Then, so in the standard long range ordered systems, Goldstone modes are elementary excitations, they are bosons. Whereas here you expect something more, spin-ons and some gauge fields. So this enlarging the Hilbert space actually helps you to view the emergent gauge fields. Okay, I will not go in. So the message is supported by phenomenology and resonating balanced potential theory, that systems described by a single band Hubbard model or a TJ model are better suited for exhibiting novel quantum spin liquid behavior and high TC superconductivity. This is something I will take it for a fact, or you know, based on phenomenology and some theory, and proceed further, see what is actually happening in real system. Now, if you are familiar with the phenomenology, not every Mott insulator, every doped Mott insulator becomes a superconductor. They are very rare. So that means there are factors that are detrimental for quantum spin liquid behavior and high TC superconductivity. They are very well-known quantum chemical things. For example, orbital degeneracy, Yontel effect, and connected strong electron phonon coupling, and polar arm formation, valence bond order, Rosen spin. So I will explain these things in some detail. So the idea is that you want to delocalize, you want to form a coherent state by putting various spin configuration in space. But if there is any tendency for valence bond order states to freeze and form kind of beautiful two-dimensional pattern or some lattice pattern, then that is detrimental for superconductivity, because there is a number phase uncertainty relation. If you locally freeze, have a sharp valence bond number, that means you don't have a sharp phase, and vice versa. So all these things that I will argue have a tendency to suppress superconductivity. In fact, this is phenomenologically very manifest in cuprates. If you take so-called single layer cuprate, there are four or five family members. And if you look at their normal state at optimal doping, they all look alike. If you look at the lattice parameter, they all look alike. If they look at J, they all look alike. Resistivity is very similar. But if you look at low temperature superconducting TC, some of them have 5 degree Kelvin superconductivity, some have 90 degree Kelvin. So there is a big swing between 5 and 90 degree Kelvin in a single family. All this is happening because there are other factors like electron phonon coupling arising from EC octahedral rotation that favors charge order or spin stripe order and so on. So in this strongly correlated system, there are lots of competing factors. So if you remove them, you can enhance TC. As we have done, it's amazing in TC, in cuprate, the first TC was 32 Kelvin. Then bilayer went to 90 Kelvin. Then trilayer went to 123. And then trilayer with pressure went up to 163 degree. In fact, there are indications recently that even at room temperature, you can induce superconductivity, at least transiently, using some light pulse. So it's a very, very interesting playground for various things. And then finally, superconductivity seems to be the winner at low temperature. But the idea is to have them in, at higher temperature. And that's where three-dimensionality comes. Because once you have three-dimensional system, fluctuations will be less. So any transition temperature can go up. So the idea is to look for some potential three-dimensional system within the quantum chemical constraint, and whether we can have higher transition temperature and new physics.
Why don't you say this orbital degeneracy is bad for liquid states?
I will come,
Okay.
I will discuss that. So we have, you know, had remarkable time with 1+1-dimensional quantum system, conformal field theory, Luttinger liquid, and a variety of things. And then with 2+1-dimensional, we have heard one fantastic time, Chern-Simons theory, and many other things that are going on currently. So who knows, in 3+1-dimensional, there may be interesting surprise. So there may be a rich variety. So that's one of the reasons that why I'm discussing this. So, So when I was making the transparency, I didn't know how to do this animation properly. So there was some scrambling of order. So this is what I want to say at the end. Materials engineering and design depends critically on choice of atomic orbitals, which facilitate formation of a single tight binding band. So here, perovskites provides a beautiful example. They are the best example. Layered perovskite cuprates, cubic perovskite, double perovskite, and then I give you the pictures of this. Perovskite basically is a folic. That is, you have a central atom B surrounded by 6 other atoms. Typically, it's oxygen. So these octahedra form share corners and form a 3-dimensional network. And then they are inscribed inside a cube where the A atom is there. So this is the very simple perovskite. Very beautiful, simple cubic lattice. So take a cubic lattice and put at the center of every elementary cube the atom B, and put at the faces this atom, oxygen atom. So you get a perovskite. It turns out this perovskite, when B is a transition metal atom, does wonderful things. They have multiferroics, magnetism, superconductivity, ferroelectrics, and a variety of things. And in this family, there is something called layered perovskite, which is this. Here what you do is, instead of making this top and octahedral corner sharing, the corner sharing, you insert another layer in between. Then you have a layered perovskite. You can do this layering in several ways. You can have double layer, triple layer. So there's a whole lot of things. And this is a very simple cubic perovskite. This is how it occurs. There are many examples. And this is a double perovskite. What is a double perovskite? So you have your cubic lattice of this B atoms. Now, your cubic lattice can be separated into 2 FCC lattices. And what you do is replace, for example, in this case, one of the FCC lattice, ruthenium atom, by lanthanum atom. So the rest is covered by. So it's basically this in which I have taken alternate the blue atom and replace it by lanthanum. And this is what you get. So it's a very simple modification.
Do you have a layered double cross set for the, you know, for the lanthanum sample? Do you have a double version of that, layered one?
I have not seen.
I see.
Yeah, layered double perovskite. Already there are, it's a good point. Already there is a problem in reality. Because in fact, this is, double perovskites are very familiar to colleagues here, Michelle and others. Very interesting magnetism, quantum magnetism. Often a problem is we theorists order them very nicely, but experimentally there are disorder. So that brings in complication. But double perovskite layered will be very interesting. I have not seen them. Maybe they exist. Okay. Now, let me take an example of a very nice Mott insulator. It's a perovskite like this. So I have lanthanum, titanium, and oxygen. So if you do valence counting, the titanium should have a spin half, one electron. So it's a spin half Mott insulator, and the wave functions nicely overlap. And its potential height is a superconductor on doping, but it's not a superconductor. What's the reason behind? There are 2 reasons. One is, when you do quantum chemistry and do solid state physics, model building, you realize that at the end of the day, in these perovskites, the most important things are this titanium d orbital. For example, in this case, after valence counting, you find the titanium is in 3+ state. And titanium in an atomic state, the 3D has 5-fold degenerate level. But once you put it inside a cube, there is crystal field splitting and also covalency effect. At the end of the day, what you do is you have a beautiful splitting. This cubic crystal field is not able to split all the degeneracy. It leaves a double degeneracy here and triple degeneracy here. So you have an electron, which can be in one of the 3 orbitals. If I draw the T2G orbital, which I have tried here, with my electronic pen. It can be in this dyz orbital or dxy orbital or dxz orbital. So these three orbitally degenerate ground states are possible. Now comes to Zhaoguang's question. When the band is narrow, orbital degeneracy becomes important in the following way. At high temperatures, electron can sit in any one of the three degenerate orbitals. There can be cooperative orbital order at low temperature and orbital domain formation. And as hopping matrix element depends on the relative orbital occupancy between neighboring orbitals, orbital fluctuations will disorder will become detrimental for metallic conduction. Let me give this example. I have one octahedra and I have another octahedra. So let me say that this electron is in this orbital. Let me say in this, this electron is this horizontal orbital. So you notice that the wave function overlap effectively goes down. So if I have a disordered array of orbitals in which electrons are ordered, then things will be bad.
So here, the amplitude actually exactly zero, right? Because of minus last time cancellation.
Exactly. Precisely. So just from symmetry, from parity, you can see it will happen. So, but then there are interesting possibilities in which these orbitals can locally order in one particular plane. So it will effectively become two-dimensional patches. But in other places, the patches may be in the other round. So in fact, experimentally, you see that there are very bad metals and various things. So we are not, if we can reach good orbital ordering, then there can be interest in physics. OK. Now, associated with this unfilled D shell, like what we have here, there is this famous Yontaler effect, which is another detrimental factor. What is Yontaler effect? Something very simple. Discovered by Yahn and Teller several decades ago. So suppose I have created, I have put an atom there, like titanium, then this is in the ground state. Now, if you imagine elongating this octahedra, like let's say along the c-axis, you will immediately realize that it's no more a cubic symmetry, the symmetry is less. So what it does is, it splits this degeneracy further, leaving one more degeneracy, and then this is. Now in the process, you notice that the electronic energy level has gone down. So if you think in terms of energy gain, you have a linear energy gain as a function of the elongation or displacement u. But of course, there is an elastic restoring force. So that will lead to u square. So if you put the energy together, you find that there is a minimum at a finite value. So this is basically what Yontaler effect is. So if there is a possibility for my system to distort and remove degeneracy, it will do so. Of course, it can't do indefinitely, it will settle down at some point. It's a beautiful, you can make it in terms of group theory and so on, make it very sophisticated. That's why it's called the Yontaler theorem. So this is a very nice example of spontaneous symmetry breaking in a finite system. So this system will spontaneously distort to gain energy. Okay. Now let's see the consequence of this. Suppose I start with the Martin cylinder, which is arbitrarily ordered. A doped hole will locally remove Yontaler distortion because there is no electron to gain energy. This will be called an Yontaler porera. But what this will do is, it leads to a large reduction in local hopping matrix element because of so-called Frank-Hondon overlap. Now if I consider an empty orbital to which an electron can hop, this electron is already in a distorted configuration. So the wave function of local phonon mode has some shape. Whereas when I go here, that local phonon oscillator is displaced, so it'll have overlap, which can make things exponentially small. So this is called Frank-Hondon overlap factor. So sometimes it leads to self-trapping of holes. So this is what you see. You see in some of these oxides, you dope holes and you expect it to become superconducting or conducting. It doesn't even become conducting, except in the case of manganite at heavy doping. So often the Yontaler effect leads to a very bad metallic state. So if it is happening in the background of singlet formation, often these charges get self-trapped and help, of course, the neighboring to form singlet, and these singlet bonds get localized. So essentially, you are freezing the Cooper pair dynamics, and then you are not doing that. So this is a problem. So this is a major problem. In fact, you can analyze most of the known oxides that exist in nature where people have been able to dope. You can rationalize why they are not conducting or why they are not superconducting based on these few important considerations. Now, two systems have overcome these hurdles and managed to become ITC superconductors, cuprates and iron nictides. So today I will focus on cuprates, a very well known and beautiful system. In fact, historically, I tell this joke to when some of you may know that Kamerling once discovered superconductivity in mercury 100 years ago, inspired by a theoretical suggestion. You may ask, who thought about superconductivity at that time? It was Lord Kelvin. He didn't talk about superconductivity, he thought about insulator. What he said was, at that time what was known was Rutherford model of nuclei and electron running around. So he said that these electrons are running around. So if you take any metal and go to sufficiently low temperature, these electrons should go back to their home site. Or the number of carriers should reduce, so it should become insulated. So Rutherford predicted that every metal should become an insulator at sufficiently low temperature. That was a fascinating suggestion, and Kamerling once wanted to prove Lord Rutherford right. So he went down and discovered superconductivity. So I tell experimentalists that you should listen to theorists. Then the second one in this context, in fact, Bednarz and Muller were inspired by a beautiful paper by Thomas and collaborators on, in this system, possible Yontaler effect and binding coming from polaronic effect. They said that if two holes sit nearby and the distortions will overlap and you will have more distortion and gain in energy. And they said that this will act like a source of Cooper pairing and then you look at superconductivity. So this is what inspired them to look for superconductivity, made them look for superconductivity. They discovered superconductivity, but not due to Yontaler effect. Due to something else. Okay. So this is ITC cuprates. Let me briefly review that this is the parent material, lanthanum copper oxide. So the valence is like this. Lanthanum becomes a closed shell after donating 3 electrons, and then oxygen becomes a closed shell after grabbing 2 electrons each. Should be 8, sorry. I'm sorry, I put the numbers wrong. So 3 times 2 plus 2 equal to 8 minus. So the finally, what is important is copper 3 2 plus, if you remember, has one hole in the D shell. Now, if you look at the crystal structure, this is not a cubic perovskite, it's a layered perovskite. And then if you look at the dimension of the elongation, it's very substantial, it's about 10 to 12%. It is not something that comes from the Yontaler effect. So basically, electrostatic forces in this direction coming from this ionic character of this material pulls this octahedra. So it's an anisotropic crystal with C-axis elongated octahedra, not because of Yontaler effect, but because of solid state chemistry. So to that extent, we don't have Yontaler effect. We won't have Yontaler polaron localization also. So in other words, if you look at copper 3D9, there are 5 levels now. They are further split by this distortion, and 6 electrons are sitting in the T2J level, and there are 3 electrons. Now this is our important electron. Now the important point is, whether I remove that electron or add an electron, it doesn't do much to the crystal dimensions, lattice parameters, because it's governed by some other electrostatic forces and other things. So that's why this system has escaped the Yontaler polaron formation, but has become a beautiful high temperature superconductor. So if you look at the basic molecular orbital unit, it's this. You say that there is one electron in this copper dx square minus y square orbital, and it strongly hybridizes with corresponding p orbital. So we call it as 3D copper and 2p oxygen symmetry adapted hybrid with a dx square minus y square symmetry. That means after a linear combination with this signs of these orbitals, it's still dx square minus wave function, but enlarged. So in fact, this is a source of confusion in the literature. Many people will say that holes are in the oxygen. It is true, but what is important is the molecular orbital which is hybridized. There may be 80% of holes in oxygen, but its parentage is x squared minus y squared orbital. And when you build the tight bending model, you will not worry about the percentage of this oxygen. You will worry about one tight bending, one Vanier orbital, which forms a bond, a two-dimensional beautiful square lattice bond. So this is something very, very important. It was there in the literature as a confusion for quite some time. Now people agree, at the end of the day, at for low energies, you should not distinguish between oxygen and the copper orbital. They are hybridized. It's a molecular orbital unit. And that is what is doing the action. And you have a super X chain, and you have a beautiful Heisenberg antiferromagnet with a J, which is about 150 milli electron volt or 1500 degree Kelvin. So this is the secret of cuprate superconductivity, in the sense it is now, if I take the superconductor and remove an electron by the process of doping, because when I dope, when I replace one of the lanthanum atom by barium, barium gives one less electron. So oxygen grabs an electron from one of the coppers, leading to a hole, for example. Now you can convince yourself this hole will form a local singlet, the so-called Jean-Grey singlet, and it's that which moves around in the corresponding TJ model. So Anderson's very important insight was that in spite of the fact there are so many orbitals per unit cell, at the end of the day, the model is described by what we call as a TJ model, a beautiful square lattice in which electrons are hopping with some nearest neighbor hopping, which is about 2.2 electron volt, and a super X chain. Now, this super X chain continues to survive until optimal doping or even more. So the model is a model in which I have to keep this constraint, namely that I came from a Mott insulator. So a double occupancy is not allowed until some very reasonable high doping. So this is called a TJ model, which has been troubling us for the last 25 years. Still, we have not solved it satisfactorily. Many, many challenges. Now, so as I said before, this can be rewritten as a model in which there is Cooper pairing between two neighboring electrons and a free conduction, but in the presence of this constraint. So this is what makes it very complicated. But now we know through various analysis that this supports high temperature superconductivity, and wonderful things happen. Okay, let me mention in passing that similar things happen in iron arsenide superconductor. There, instead of octahedral network, you have tetrahedra which share edges and so on. The physics is a little more complicated because there are two orbitals and it's like a two-coupled cuprate system. I will not go into the details. How much time do I have?
17 minutes.
17 minutes? Oh, good. So now we look for three-dimensional analogs, having gained some insight like this. Is it possible to have a three-dimensional? Of course, it's possible. If you wish to avoid orbital degeneracy, one possibility is to have an S orbital. S orbital is orbitally non-degenerate. Indeed, there is an example, which is again a cubic perovskite, in which if you do valence counting, what you will find is there is one bismuth 4s orbital which carries one electron. So it's a very beautiful cubic perovskite. But if you look at the experiments, which I have no time to go into, what you find is it remains insulating until about 30% of doping. You can dope the system by taking some amount of barium away and then replace it by potassium. So that dopes the system. So in spite of doping, it remains insulating. Then all of a sudden, at about 30% of doping, superconductivity occurs at 40 Kelvin and then disappears. So it looks exactly like cuprates, except that it waits for a long time before superconductivity comes. Now, the theory for this is controversial. I have been, and also Anderson to some extent, saying that this is a positive U-Hubbard model, and many people are of the view that it's a negative U-Hubbard model, so we are directly opposite. But there are many, many phenomenology which indicates that many things interesting to cuprate happens in three dimensions. But the major problem, in my view, is here in this system, the octahedral rotation allows for strong electron-phonon coupling. And then basically what you have until about 30% of doping is valence bond order arising from strong spin-phonon coupling. Then you need a very high doping, and you manage to get 40 Kelvin, which is a respectable number. Now, there are other compounds like chiral phase compounds, A15 compounds. They are called actually bad actors from the standard BCS theory point of view, because you can't explain everything in terms of Fermi liquid theory and standard parameters and Eliasberg theory. And if you look at this with all this recent insight, Perhaps they also belong to this family of strong correlated system, but with a lot of multi-orbital complications. So I will not go into detail.
Excuse me.
Yes.
This 40 Kelvin TC is a confirmed, it's the Meissen effect, all that.
Sorry?
That's confirmed, you have this 40 Kelvin superconductivity.
Yeah.
With the Meissen effect.
Oh yeah, this is a very well studied. Yeah, yeah. This 40 Kelvin superconductor is well established. Beautiful tunneling, Meissner effect.
I see.
Oh yeah, this variable.
This is a, because of the other thing, no, let me see. You know, the two examples mentioned are just all two-dimensional.
Yes.
And this, the TC so high, the three-dimensional is quite surprising.
Yes, so this is a, you know,
very amazing.
Unfortunately, it's a ceramic, unlike MgB2.
I see.
Which has good mechanical property, you can draw wires and so on.
I see.
That also the TC is very close. So barium bismuth oxide with potassium doping is a 40 Kelvin bulk superconductor, which exhibits Meissner effect. They have done Josephson tunneling and various things.
So what is known about the pairing state?
It's a nice S state with a good gap. There are no nodes.
So the S wave?
It's an S wave state. So if you do a very simple RVB theory, taking this Hubbard model point of view, what you find is you get an extended S wave.
And this one is induced by phone up by some Young Taylor effect.
Right. So this is the, so people say that in this case, there is what is called charge disproportionation. That is, it is well known that this, okay, let me go into some quantum chemistry. It's well known that bismuth bismuth 4 plus is, that means 4s, one electron. Now, there are indications that if you look at molecules in chemistry and so on, that the system likes valency 2 plus or 5 plus. Or 4 plus. So, this can be mean valence. So, the statement is in this system, some of the bismuth going to 2 plus, some of the system going to 4 plus, and so it's like a charge density. So the popular picture is it's a charge density. But the greatest problem with the charge density interpretation is any experiment that you do, you don't find a large charge proportionation that people expect. For example, the gap is 2 electron. And if you think in terms of charge density wave and electron photon coupling, you don't get 2 electron volt in these systems. You get maybe 0.2 electron volt. And then any measurement that looks at this relative charge variation, they find less than 1% charge variation. So in spite of that, people go ahead and form theories. Right from the beginning, we have been skeptical about negative U Hubbard model for this. We believe that it's a positive U Hubbard model. We need to do some more experiment. Yeah, this is I wish, you know, I have time to go into this, it's a fascinating system. Now, I will describe two successful examples. One is, which is known to fullerite, is a well-established superconductor, Meissner effect and so on. This ruthenium-based double perovskite, there are some issues. I will come to it. Okay. Now, here it's a very nice, so ruthenium actually has been playing a very important role in condensed matter physics in the last 20, 30 years. People discovered in layered ruthenate, SR2RuO4, we have p-wave superconductivity, a possible candidate, the vertices there, half vertices are possible candidate for Majorana fermions. And then this cubic perovskite is a fascinating system which we still don't understand. It's a ferromagnet with spin-orbit coupling physics and so on. Now you take that cubic perovskite and replace half of the ruthenium atom in a periodic fashion by lanthanum or yttrium, you can do it in, or you can have, instead of strontium, you can have barium. So you get this perovskite, double perovskite. Now if you look at the charge states, you have ruthenium 5 plus, and it's a 4d3 spin system. So lanthanum octahedra form in FCC lattice, but lanthanum 3 plus is a closed shell, so it's inactive. So you, what you have found is now you have a perovskite in which half of the active magnetic sites have become inactive, and the active magnetic sites form an FCC lattice. That's an important point. So if you look at the electronic structure, ruthenium 5 plus is in 4d3 plus. So nominally, we can put this all spin in parallel in this 3 state. It's amazing that because of some interesting quantum chemistry, which I will refer to soon, Hund coupling and spin orbit coupling seems less effective. This can be the statement that you can make from phenomenology, and this family of ruthenium and iridium systems, Warren Pickett has tried to rationalize it through LDA calculations. But phenomenologically, it's an interesting fact that for some of them, it is as if spin orbit coupling is not there, and also Hund coupling is less effective. So I will take this as a fact and then proceed further. Now let's look at the quantum chemistry. It's very interesting that if you look at an octahedra in which ruthenium atom is there, there are three orbitals, d, y, z as before, x, y, z, x, and you can put the three electrons. Now since they form an FCC lattice, let me take one of the face. These are the four corners and one center of the face. And if you look at wave function overlap, for example, the largest overlap occurs between this, what it will be called, the x, y, and yz orbital because of the following reason. So, if for example, if we take two neighboring octahedra, this and this can communicate through this oxygen orbital in phase like this. So, what you find is the Hopping matrix element between similar orbitals in that same yz phase is non-zero. Whereas if you take two neighboring orbitals as before, what you find is because of parity, this is zero. So immediately you can say that I have a very natural decoupling of the orbitals into xy plane orbitals or xy band, yz band and zx band. So there's something straightforward that happens here. So at the end of the day, what we have is we have three nearly decoupled two-dimensional tight bending bands, or three single band repulsive Hubbard model or TJ model. Individual bands are similar to cuprates in terms of square lattice symmetry. So the parameter T can be inferred from existing band structure calculation and experiment, and the J also can be inferred from neutron scattering and other results. So if you assume that based on phenomenology that Hund coupling, interorbital U, and they are all renormalized, essentially you have three cuprates living in this three-dimensional world. And each H, X, Y is a TJ model if you dope it. Let me, so individual bands from Mott insulator exhibit two-dimensional Lagrange order. However, when you want to put them together, there is a problem. That's where FCC lattice frustrates this Lagrange order and leads to interesting physics. The end result is two of them form long range order and the third one forms a spin liquid state. This is what I will try to argue. So before I go into that, it's very interesting to spend some 5 minutes on magnetism in FCC lattice. Yes?
So why is inter-orbital U smaller than intra-orbital U? You said inter-orbital U is smaller.
Exactly. So I do not know. So I'm taking it as a phenomenological fact. To prove it, there has been some attempt by in the other iridium and other context by Warren Pickett and others. I am at the moment taking it as a phenomenological fact and then see consistency with experiments.
In general, we expect them to be the same order of magnitude.
So, I will come to it during the discussion. This is a very important point. See, this is at the heart of various things, including low spin, high spin physics. For example, if you take cobalt, it's well known that depending on its charge state, it doesn't always go into the highest spin state. Iron also does that. So this is something related to fight between crystal field splitting and Hund coupling. Now, those things have been, now when there is more covalency in the system, those competition becomes less severe. And you can go between these two easily. We can discuss it at length. Yeah. So, FCC lattice is a very interesting lattice from frustration point of view. So, three-dimensional FCC lattice is a counterpart of two-dimensional triangular lattice. We know that If we take today triangular lattice, if you take an elementary triangle, there is a frustration. Now, analog of elementary triangle in FCC lattice is a tetrahedron. Every face has a frustration. So at the end of the day, two-thirds of the bonds are happy and one-third is unhappy. So we start with the nearest neighbor Heisenberg, Heisenberg antiferromagnet. It's not possible to form an antiferromagnetic order that will satisfy every bond. So frustrated spin system, ground state has a macroscopic degeneracy. In reality, many interesting things happen. In fact, this is a whole story, what is called order by disorder. That is, if you think about continuous spins like Heisenberg spin, like we had 120 degree order as a ground state in triangular lattice, you can imagine a state in which the spins point radially outwards from the center through these corners of the tetrahedron, the analog of 120 degree order. So this is the so-called non-coplanar order. It could satisfy, it could be a ground state, but finally, thermal fluctuations or quantum fluctuation does not stabilize that order. And what they stabilize is some beautiful order called type 1 or type 2, type 3 antiferromagnets. This is well known. So if you take this FCC lattice, this is the tetrahedron I was showing before. It can be separated into four sublattices, A, B, C, and D. At the end of the day, the order that you have is something very simple. You take one of these phases, it's a two sublattice antiferromagnet. You come to the next phase, it's a two sublattice, because it's a square lattice, each phase is a square lattice. So it's a two sublattice antiferromagnet with sublattice switching like this and more. But now what is interesting is, if you look at this XY plane, so even the nearest neighbor spins are parallel. So all the frustration is put in this plane. White plane, that is white atoms and dark atoms and white atoms. So vertical planes are very happy. Horizontal planes, nearest neighbor interactions are frustrated. You can construct another thing in which, you remember, FCC lattice can be thought of as stacks of triangular lattices. So there you make them ferromagnetic and make them alternate, you get another type. I will not go into the detail. What is interesting is that for some other purpose, it's nice to view this elementary FCC lattice as edge sharing tetrahedron. I will not go into the detail. So now I will not go into the details because there is no time. I took a lot of time in summary of the result is the following. That is, you get type, because I will have three sublattices which are interpenetrating, and I would like all of them to be antiferromagnetically ordered, and it turns out that's not possible. So you can get type 1 antiferromagnetics in the following way. That is, two out of the three 2D subsystems have long-range antiferromagnetic order. So that will correspond to our these planes, that is the XZ and YZ planes, vertical planes. So coupling among themselves are happy and they form antiferromagnetic order. And for example, for this, the corresponding orbital is XZ and YZ and so on. For this, the orbital is different. So if you come back to the three subsystem model, two out of the two subsystems, two out of 3D two-dimensional subsystems for antiferromagnetic long-range order, the third one continues to be a spin ring. So if I worry about, if I ignore the residual coupling, what I have is I have a three-dimensional Brillouin zone and I have sheets of pseudo-Fermi surfaces. Or for one of the part, the others develop long-range antiferromagnetic order, or I could have a gap. So, or I can view it as a three-dimensional spin-on Fermi surface with partial antiferromagnetic. And what is interesting is, in this picture, the low energy spectrum will consist of some spin-on-like excitations and also Goldstone antiferromagnetic modes. In fact, I came to this idea after coming here, inspired by a very beautiful paper that came from McMaster group, neutron scattering on some of these ruthenite systems. So I'm sorry, I have no time to go into the details. I can explain it to anybody interested. Then the Topmotz insulator becomes very interesting. I have two subsystems which are antiferromagnetic ordered. I have one system which is a spin liquid, so you can easily receive holes and make it superconducting. So from this point of view, this is very interesting that you make one of the subsystems superconducting, the other remains antiferromagnetic. And of course, after some time, the holes would like to delocalize and go everywhere, and then you have a possibility of destroying all antiferromagnetic order. So what you find is within the simple mean field theory ideas, you have some superconducting dome with some structures. What about experiments? Unfortunately, experiments, let me look at the experiments. M.K. Wu observed superconductivity in this doped ruthenium double perovskite in 1999 or 2000. And there was, in fact, in some of the system, they even observed room superconductivity at 60 Kelvin. But they see stable room temperature superconductivity at 30 Kelvin in many, many systems, including some recent work SM Rao and MK collaborators have done. But there is no systematic study as a function of doping like that you have done in cuprate because of materials problem. See, as I said, firstly, you need to have a three-dimensional order of these two sublattices. And then you need to dope. Here, in most of the work, MKO has done doping by removing ruthenium and replacing it by copper. Apparently, the chemistry is better for that particular substitution. So this is to me, so I'm going to talk to experimental colleagues and go back to ruthenate and do it carefully. In fact, it's in such a bad state, not even one neutron scattering experiment result is available after doping in the superconducting state. Whereas this is in a very good comfortable state. I think this is the system I was talking about, SR2 lanthanum, RuO6, yeah, barium. I mean, the same family. Beautiful experiments have been done. Then I was familiarizing myself with the literature. There are very interesting things in which you can have D2, D1, and very surprising. For example, at D1, you expect the Antler effect. In some of the systems, you don't see Antler effect. The reason is that here these orbitals are 4D and 5D orbitals are more extended and they go out of the octahedra. And the crystal field splitting issue is different now, spin orbit coupling is different. Lots of interesting physics is there. In fact, similar ruthenium system in pyrochlore have a lot of spin liquid physics, a very interesting spin ice physics. This is on a very simple FCC lattice. Now this is something I have no time to. This is a system that, you know, I was long back when superconductivity in fullerites was discovered. I, for one, along with Erio Tosati, we were pushing the importance of electron correlation. In parallel, Steve Kivelson and Subir Sachdev were pushing. For quite some time, that was unpopular theory, saying that BCS theory works very well. But very recently, not in the last 10 years, significant progress has taken place. What they have taken is they have taken this system, and you can expand this. For example, I should say there is a 3RB3C60, K3C60, for example. You expand the system by putting ammonia molecule. There is enough space for that. Once it expands, it becomes a MOT antiferromagnet. That's an experimental fact. And then you pressurize the system, it becomes superconducting. And if you look at the crystal structure of this, C60 molecules form a beautiful FCC lattice, like this ruthenium system. And the so-called LUMO, lowest unoccupied molecular orbital, where these three electrons go, is triply degenerate, like our T2G. So as far as model Hamiltonian and physics is concerned, it's very similar to ruthenate, surprisingly. So this is something that I have not, I'm right now analyzing my old work from this point of view. So I think this will be also very interesting. So let me conclude by saying that if one takes care of orbitals and their role, there seems to be more room, very interesting room for superconductivity and spin liquid physics in cubic systems like this. And the way that I have shown, at least I have studied this, looks like direct product of three cuprates. You know, like there are layers of cuprates. And of course, when you tie them together, many new things may emerge. I have just, I think, pointed out this very interesting possibility. And I think if more experiments can be done, there will be beautiful and interesting surprises. And also theory needs to be done. Thank you for your attention.
So this is three-dimensional carbon peroxide. You say there's a superconductivity. What is the TC?
Which one? Three?
What, this is the last example, the last transparency.
What TC is particle? Amazing.
This is double one, also 40.
Yeah, yeah. And what, yeah, if, let me draw the phase diagram.
It's 40, it's a mystery
number. 40, yeah, exactly. So if you look at the superconducting, which is better for the audience, that or this? Okay, let me. So the experiment that was.
You can just raise the blackboard.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of erasing.
So oh, erase, okay, yeah, thank you. That degree of freedom, yeah. Thank you. So what you find is, you can, so you take this system K3C60 and put ammonia. So what, so K3C60 forms a beautiful FCC lattice. So ammonia enters and expands the lattice. And then it becomes at zero pressure an antiferromagnet, not insulator, with a TC of about 50 Kelvin. And then you apply pressure to that system. And then at a critical pressure, it becomes superconducting with a TC of about 40 Kelvin. So the TC is as large as 40 Kelvin for this organic system.
But the previous one, the one with the double peroxide?
That varies from, there are some people claim it's 60 Kelvin, some people claim it's 30 Kelvin. So because they have no good control over 30.
I see.
Doping.
60,
yeah. In fact, I don't want.
60.
Yeah.
60.
60.
Six zero?
Yeah. See. Yeah, this MK Wu's experiment. If you talk to him privately, he thinks it could be like cuprate, you know, it could go to 90. But the materials control is very difficult. He is, you know, single-handedly, he and some group at Tata Institute, they have been pushing this.
60, that'll be the first Rusnik based.
Sorry?
It's not copper based, this is Rusnik based.
Exactly. It's pure ruthenate based, yeah. In fact, among non-copper based, iron superconductor so far has been holding the fourth, because there it's reproducible, you have very good control over the materials property.
So this one have a 60, but it's not, may not be reproducible.
Exactly. So, you know, there is a lot, in fact, around 2000, there was a lot of debate whether it's coming from some minority phase when you make this material involving copper and so on. They have excluded. So it's worth studying, you know, from.
But here you emphasize this material may locally looks like a 2D because local orbital order. Whether there's any evidence of this local orbital order.
No study exists. So the only study that exists are thermodynamic measurements of resistivity, Meissner effect, and some susceptibility.
But the formula is a 3D material.
Yeah, not even R-phase, for example. You could look at some surface and there is no R-phase result available. So I want to talk to some experimental colleagues and push this. From theory point of view also, it's challenging. You know, it may open up door for some new classifications and varieties.
You know, I just
imagine
like questions. Could there be something that's genuinely 3D? I mean, assuming that your story is right, that this is sort of effectively 3D, even though it's in a bulk,
exactly,
a dimensional bulk.
So,
could there be any mechanisms that would be genuinely three-dimensional?
Something new. For example, barium bismuth oxide is a genuinely 3D superconductor. There again, for its metallicity, the TC is high. For example, you know, you can define a dimensionless transition temperature. If you do that, these organic superconductors are like better than cuprates, because in spite of having a very low carrier density, they manage to get 40 Kelvin superconductivity. So from that point of view, barium bismuth oxide, in spite of having a very bad resistivity profile, very bad metal, it manages to get 40 Kelvin superconductivity. So your question whether there can be a genuinely new mechanism in 3D, I do not know. So far I have, you know, taken what I know from 2D and try to, as always happens, you know. I think maybe there are some new mechanisms, particularly, you know, when from talking in terms of effective field theory, in 2D you are governed by Chern-Simons field theory. When you go to 3D, you have theta terms, which are becoming very popular in condensed matter physics. So some of those things may appear. It will be worth investigating.
So you mentioned that, yeah, there's a coupling between the xy, yz, and zx orbitals, and this is sort of based on the fact that spinor coupling and Kunz coupling are not effective somehow.
Yes. So
what was the reason? I mean, you said there's some phenomenological reason. But is there any?
So, for example, Kunz couplings are very effective in crowded environment when things are very atomic-like. Now here what you find is the communication, these are all bigger orbitals, and then the communication is not between nearest neighbor and the old perovskite, it's between the diagonally opposite. So now why should that reduce Kunz coupling? I do not know. In fact, honestly, I mean, this has been one of the phenomenological fact, you know, and worries also for theorists. This is not the only system. Some iridium systems also where you expect the Antler effect and spin Kunz coupling. It plays not in all iridium systems, in some of the systems. So there is some deep quantum chemistry or something going on which I don't understand.
So the spin orbit coupling is local, so that wouldn't really matter if you have
it. No, you see, if your wave function due to, yeah, this is a point, spills over. Yeah. See, if, so in our mind we think in terms of rubidium d orbital. But in cuprate, never mind, we think in terms of dx square minus y square orbital. If at the end of the day, it hybridizes very strongly with oxygen, and there's a lot of amplitude there. So any spin orbit coupling will come from the core, from near the core. So something like that, because if you look at the extent of the ruthenium d orbital, and the way it communicates with its, yeah, see, so this hybridizes very strongly with four of the oxygen p orbital. So I have no idea at the moment what is the parentage of this wave function in this. If it spills over very strongly here, there is a possibility that spin orbit coupling will and Kunz coupling will be reduced. This is what happens in complexes. For example, in ion complexes and various things. Even though nominally there is an ion d orbital, there is a very strong hybridization. So low spin state, high spin state come down in energy. So here I have, you know, no clear idea. I'm taking it as a phenomenological fact.
Other questions? It's like Bhaskar.